BCFM is the award-winning community radio station for Bristol, and it's here to give everybody in Bristol a voice. BCFM 93.2. Bristol is our community. Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show, Friday Drive Time, with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Ken Clark's legal aid changes means if you're broke, you won't get justice unless you represent yourself. Justice Secretary Ken Clark's making big changes to who can and who can't get free help from lawyers. Will Stone and Chris Kelson are here from the Avon and Bristol Law Centre in an attempt to explain why. Plus, nationalist journalist Martin O'Hagan was murdered in front of his wife on the streets of Belfast 10 years ago this week. He was writing about the Orange Order and loyalist sects, and he was the only journalist to be killed in the troubled province in the last 20 or so years. News out this week suggests his killers were helped by and have also been protected by the British security services. And is the Pakistani intelligence service, the ISI, aiding terror attacks against NATO forces' supply lines in Pakistan? America's war of words continues, but what's really going on and where is this heading? Plus, big shifts in Russia and China. Moscow fires its long-time finance minister. Beijing opens its first big office up in space. We find out why. But first, 2 weeks ago, on Friday the 16th of September, this programme included reference to a new 2-hour-long internet film about the London bombings. It's called 7-7 Crimes and Prejudice by Tom Secker. Tom has kindly pointed out that Martin Summers referred in a discussion we had about that film to John Loftus as the former Attorney General of the United States, which he isn't. Loftus was, in fact, an FBI special prosecutor, appointed at the time of President Jimmy Carter to track down former Nazi war criminals resident in the United States. John Loftus is also the author of a new book, America's Nazi Secret, and is a director of the Intelligence Summit, which is a US think tank. Apologies for the error, and thanks to Tom Secker for pointing it out. Now, Conservative Justice Secretary and former Director of British American Tobacco, Kenneth Clark, is introducing big changes in legal aid. That is, who is not allowed free help from lawyers when they find themselves in a legal dispute. The Legal Aid Sentencing and Punishment of Offenders Bill, that's a bit of a mouthful, isn't it? But according to Ken, it's going to prune back the compensation culture encouraged by the last Labour government. I'm joined now by two people from the Avon and Bristol Law Centre, which you can find at the bottom of Stokes Croft. That's Will Stone and Chris Kelson. Hi, Will and Chris, and welcome to Drive Time.
Hey.
Now, what is the Avon and Bristol Law Centre? You first, Will.
Well, the Avon and Bristol Law Centre is a charity that's been running in Bristol since the early 1980s. We provide a free legal help and representation service from our legal staff, our legal teams. We have solicitors and we have caseworkers. We also provide services for people to see volunteer solicitors from some of the bigger law firms in Bristol as well. And in a sense, we kind of are a mix between the Citizens Advice Bureau and a firm of solicitors, in that we will give advice, but we will also take on your case and represent you at courts and tribunals if necessary.
So do you find that most of the people coming to you, where they are actually having to react to something which is going through the courts, so you're there to sort of help defend them, or is it the other way around?
Well, I mean, people come to us because they have a problem. They may have been referred to us from the Citizens Advice Bureau or from other support organisations. A legal problem has arisen. For example, it may well be that they're a tenant who are facing eviction proceedings. It may well be...
If it's an eviction, then you've probably just got some sort of legal notice stuck up in the front of your door, and you think, well, goodness me, what's this? And so they'll tear that off the front of the door, come around and have a chat with you.
It would start long before that, yes. I mean, they would get a notice from their landlord to say that the landlord wishes to regain possession of the property and state the reasons at that point, and quite often, actually, it's even at a much later point, they will come to see us and ask for our help.
Because I think sometimes people can be almost in denial, can't they? Saying,
they can.
Well, I actually don't really want to deal with this now. I'd much rather go and sit down in the garden and have a cup of tea.
That's right. I mean, I've seen people who have received the notice from the court to say they're going to be evicted the following week, and they had never opened any of the letters because they just didn't want to think about it. People go into a kind of panic mode, which puts them in denial. They just don't want to know about it. They don't want to think about it.
Now, obviously, it's a good idea to get a bit of advice as soon as possible, but is there anything you can do in that situation where it looks like some dreadful event like an eviction is imminent?
There's always something that you can do, and that's why you need to go and see a lawyer, because if you're going to do something in that situation, it means you have to make use of the courts. You have to get your case in front of a judge and to argue to the judge that it is not a reasonable course of action for the person to be evicted. It could be a variety of reasons. It may well be that there are arrears of rent which have arisen simply because the person hasn't had their benefit properly calculated, or there has been a delay. There are lots of delays in benefit calculations. The money hasn't come through. The landlord goes for eviction. We can argue for the judge this is not the fault of the tenant. It's the fault of perhaps the housing benefit office, or there may be other reasons.
Okay, Chris, what's your role at the Avon Law Centre?
I work with the immigration team, and we do immigration and asylum casework. I do casework support with the solicitors there.
So what does that mean in practice? How likely is it if someone actually comes to you saying, look, it looks like they're going to try and deport me, what's your first move?
Again, that's as Will was saying, that's going to be one of the last stages of someone.
Oh, is it? Okay.
It is possible they could come at that stage, but more often we'll see someone earlier than that, hopefully before they've been detained as well. People will come with all kinds of problems. Immigration obviously is quite separate to asylum, and it's just immigration that's being hit by the cuts. We are still going to be able to provide free legal advice for people with asylum issues, although there is going to be some overlap, sadly. With immigration cases, the overlap I'm talking about would be the refugee family reunion. Currently there's a policy whereby if you've been recognised as a refugee in this country and you've been given leave to remain for 5 years, you can then apply for your pre-existing family to come over. So not if you've got married since, for example, but your wife, your husband, your children, you can apply for them to come over, and they're going to be scrapping for the funding for those applications with these cuts. So that's a little bit of an overlap between immigration and asylum there, but generally things are a bit more down the middle, and immigration, as I said, is going to be totally withdrawn from legal help.
Now, what's your thoughts though? Because ultimately, a lot of people out there think that actually that we shouldn't be paying to help people to actually stay in the country if there is actually a legal case.
Absolutely.
That they should, that they've come in here without going through the proper procedures and without getting permission to stay.
That's you're talking about people who have come in illegally. That's quite a small proportion of people that we assist. Obviously, immigration and asylum is a I don't want to say it's such a cliche. It is a hot potato. It's politically very difficult, and obviously the current government is doing what they can to move even further down
the road.
So this
is really a political move, is what you're saying?
I think it is largely, yes, because immigration asylum in this country since the Aliens Act of like 1904 or something is the first time we actually started to legislate against people coming into the country, with subsequent issues around the world. Obviously the world wars, immigrants around that time, the way that gradually over time since the turn of the last century we've been restricting and further restricting our borders, and this is just another move towards that as far as I can tell.
So I mean, what is this actually going to mean for immigration, people who are immigrants and asylum seekers? Is it going to mean that they're going to have to, if it looks like that they may be deported, they're going to have to do all their own work and legal research, not the asylum seekers, but just general immigration cases? People are going to have to actually fight their own cases.
Absolutely right, yeah. Another one of the issues we're particularly worried about is the where it infringes on the European Court of Human Rights. The one in particular is Article 8, which is, as I said, European court, so it's not part of the UK government legislation, so it has to be respected to a certain degree. But this will be cases where people have family members in the UK. Article 8 basically means it's your right to respect for a private and family life. So the courts, the UK courts, have repeatedly said that these cases are too complex for people to deal with by themselves, but the government obviously wants to reduce the funding in this area and let people try and deal with them by themselves.
Sounds like there's a little bit of a conflict there between British law and European law. How does that work its way through?
A little, yes.
Or enormous.
In the same way, you might say there's a conflict between the Geneva Convention on asylum as well. But yeah, it's a bit more contentious perhaps with the European Convention on Human Rights, definitely.
Now, Will, can you just take us through some of the different areas? We've heard about immigration and asylum seekers, but I know that there are quite a lot of different types of law that's going to be affected by this. Private family law, such as divorce and custody battles, clinical negligence claims, employment and education law, and some debt, housing and benefit issues.
That's right, yeah. Welfare benefits, for example, is going to be taken completely out of the legal aid system. Now, that doesn't really make sense just if you add the figures up. There was an article today, which is in fact by the Law Centre, in the Western Daily Press, and one of the points that made was that with regards to welfare benefits cases, last year we managed to bring in £1 million in unclaimed or incorrectly assessed benefits for over the whole year for about 200 clients. Now that cost in legal aid terms about £160 per case. So anybody looking at it would see that is a pretty good return on taxpayers' money. It brings £1 million into Bristol's economy. It strengthens the economy. And surely that's what we should be doing at a time when we're being told our economy is getting weaker and weaker.
Well, I think what Ken Clark would say is we'd actually rather not pay these benefits.
Well, what Ken Clark may well say that's a completely different issue, but the fact is the law of the United Kingdom says that people are entitled to these benefits. Now, if the government wants to go down the route of abolishing those benefits, that's a completely different debate, I think. But where those benefits are lawful, people are lawfully entitled to them, for them to claim them and have those claims correctly and legally assessed, and that bringing money into the economy, which is then spent in Bristol's shops and services, is surely a very good return on taxpayers' money. And the government should be looking at the whole economy, and not just in this case the budget of the Justice Department.
What about the idea of clinical negligence claims? Because I can imagine that it's very difficult to know if one of your relatives has been harmed in hospital, or you have been harmed as part of something that's gone on as part of your medical treatment. That's actually a really complicated issue.
It is, and it's particularly difficult where the person involved is a child, because quite often, although you may be in negotiations with the other side as to how much money that person should get, it's very difficult to assess how much that person's going to get right at the beginning of the case. That's why clinical negligence cases, particularly with regards to children, tend to last a long time and tend to end up with quite a high bill. Now, if that case is run properly, those legal costs would be paid by the losing side. What the clinical negligence solicitors are asking for. Now, we don't do clinical negligence at the Law Centre, but what I understand the clinical negligence solicitors are saying is that we need the money up front in order to run those cases. If at the end of the day we get a good settlement for the client, that money will be paid back to the legal aid budget, and that's what tends to happen. And of course, at the same time, the government is making statements about changing the no-win, no-fee arrangements, which of course is going to mean that people are not going to have firms of solicitors who are going to be looking to take on their cases. It's going to be much more difficult for you to get your case taken on, and that makes it more important that there is a legal aid system underpinning those cases.
Now, one of the things I noticed that you do, which I rather like, is that you're able also to signpost people when they come in for advice. If it's not a case that you can deal with yourself, you're able to point people in the direction of specialist solicitors in other parts of the city that can do that. I mean, surely that's actually a really important role.
That is, and I mean, that's why I say we operate a little bit like private firm solicitors, but we also operate a bit like a citizens advice bureau. We've got the contacts with the local solicitors. We've also got contacts with specialist lawyers and barristers in London that we can call on, and we do call on to give free advice. Quite often we get free help that isn't paid for by the legal aid budget. But if we can't survive as an organisation because one of our main streams of funding, which is legal aid, is cut, then those clients will no longer have that facility to be able to be signposted to the correct people.
Now, one of the things Ken Clark would say, I may be playing devil's advocate here a bit, but if he was here, he would be saying, well, actually, what I want to do is I want to encourage, rather than public money being spent on these cases, I want to encourage solicitors and barristers to work pro bono, work for nothing, because to have a look at a case, see if they think it's a winnable case, and then only if it's a winnable case, according to that solicitor, would it then proceed. Surely that's a good idea.
No win, no fee.
Well, that does happen.
The no win, no fee
yeah.
idea.
I mean, that does happen already, but I mean, some of the changes to the no win, no fee agreements, as I understand it, are going to mean that a lot of those solicitors will just not be able to exist. They will not be able to run those large offices without having the funding up front that they get from private clients. So they will reduce the amount of work that they do. We've already seen that happening when a number of years ago legal aid for immigration was reduced and reduced and reduced. Many firms that had been very successful and had been operating very good services in London and across the UK had to close down overnight. They just could not afford to keep paying the rent for their offices.
One of the things that you pointed out to me in one of these articles that you sent me, it actually is saying that for every £31 spent in civil legal aid early advice, it saves up to 10 times that in reduced costs from other demand-led budgets such as health, social care and housing. Now, this is quite an interesting one. So what you're essentially saying here is that actually by getting good legal advice at an early stage, it can actually save money in the long term. That's right.
And in fact, it's even better than that, because about the email that I sent you had an error in it. It rather than £31, it's actually a pound. For every pound that is spent in civil legal aid, early advice can save up to £10,000 in reduced costs from other demand-led organisations.
Well, could you just give us an example of that?
A good example is the housing one. The person who is evicted, let's say that they're a vulnerable person, they then have to present themselves as homeless to the local authority. Whilst that is happening, they may well be living rough. So the local authority then has to assess their homeless applications, has to pay for temporary housing for them. They may well, because they've been living rough, develop health needs. They then have to go to the health service. There may be social problems, so social services have to step in. It's actually much cheaper to spend a little bit of money and keep that person in the secure, clean, healthy environment that they're already in than to put them on the streets and create a demand within the housing department, the local housing homeless department, and the local health services and the local social services. Much cheaper to do that.
Let's talk a bit about the timing of this, because we're in the sort of middle of this kind of, I mean, it started really in 2008, but we're certainly now it's becoming clear that there's a strong possibility we've got in a double dip recession with lots and lots more demands on the sorts of services that you provide. So how is this change in legal aid, if it goes through, actually going to affect what you do?
Well, it's going to change quite a lot, really. I mean, for example, employment. Now, that's an area that Ken Clark is suggesting should be taken completely out of the legal aid budget. And so there will be no legal aid for people to get advice and assistance if they suddenly find that they're without a job. Now, we found over the past 2 years the increase in the number of people who are contacting our centre because they've either been sacked, they've been made redundant, or they're having other problems at work has increased probably, I would say, about four times. That's one of the specialist areas that I work in. And I do a lot of help with people who where perhaps they're coming up to retirement, and rather than make them redundant, the employer will just simply sack them or will change their job without their agreement. And people need to get some advice. They need to know what to do.
So can you just run us through what your basic legal rights are as an employee? I mean, you've got a contract, you're working to a contract, and what you're saying then is that any changes to that contract, not just saying that you've got the sack, but if you're being asked to work in different ways, for example, that actually could be something that they would need to get an agreement with you before they can do that, not just simply tell you what to do.
That's right. It has to be a fundamental change in your terms and conditions of employment. A good example may be that a business decides to close a local office in Bristol to relocate all the staff to Swindon. Now, it may well be impractical for many of those members of staff to travel to Swindon every day, so essentially their job is redundant. But the employer may make an argument to say, well, either you go to Swindon or you're out, and just simply dismiss that person.
So your rights are, when you're made redundant, what are your rights?
If you're made redundant, you're entitled to redundancy pay.
Which is roughly, I mean, sort of, can you just give us just a general idea? Because, I mean, I think, you know, obviously cases differ from one to the other, but that means that you're entitled to quite a large sum, depending on the length of time that you've actually been employed.
Well, that's right. I mean, you would need, first of all, to look at your contract of employment. Many contracts of employment give quite generous redundancy packages, particularly in the better jobs. We may well have been aware of many of the people who were dismissed from the News of the World, some of whom may have been acting unlawfully, receiving quite large packages which would have come from their contracts. But then there are the statutory redundancy rights. Those aren't quite so generous. Basically, you get a week's salary for each year that you've been there, plus you're entitled to a week's notice as well, so that could be as much as, say, 24 week salary, which for people on an average wage is not an awful lot of money, but it's enough to tide you over until you can get another job.
Now, Chris Kelson, in the first hour of the show, we had Barbara Jenk, leader of Bristol City Council, here talking about one specific asylum case that's been going on this week. Can you just give us an idea of how the changes are likely to affect this kind of case? Because she wasn't, I think I'm right in saying that she only would start to get free legal advice once she's been detained.
Sorry, I wasn't aware of that case.
This is an asylum case that's been happening this week. I just want you, mate, I'm not asking you to talk about this specific case at all, really. Just generally, in this sort of situation, how does it actually affect the life of somebody who's maybe been here for 10, 20 years and suddenly finds that they're getting letters through the post saying you don't have an entitlement to stay in the country anymore?
I think it was absolutely devastating. How would you feel? You're suddenly being told you have to leave the country you've made a home in for 20 years, or tried to make a home in for 20 years. As an asylum seeker, then obviously with the government, the onus is on you to prove reasons why you're seeking asylum in this country, and it has to be for one of the Geneva Convention reasons. Basically, I don't know if you want me to go into those, but yeah. They are that you have to show that you've got a well-founded fear of persecution, and that can be for reasons of race, religion, nationality, membership of a particular social group, or having a particular political opinion. So you need to be able to prove that, and obviously it's very difficult to prove something like that. Say, for example, if you're fleeing from Zimbabwe and you've got to show you're a member of the opposition party, the political party there, how do you prove it? You've fled. You've left as soon as you could because your life was in danger. And obviously you need to, and you're making your case for to be given refugee status or asking for refugee status, trying to get that kind of evidence from a country where you fled in a hurry is practically impossible. In terms of the case you're talking about, that somebody would only be entitled to legal aid, this person you said only on being detained, as far as I'm aware, we assess everyone's eligibility, legal help, and the other side of that, controlled legal representation, is all means tested. It's all just tested on people's income. It's only available to those on a low income, but it's available to them at any stage.
Well, so I've just got some figures here, because it says currently anyone with disposable assets of less than £8,000 can qualify for legal aid, but that, it looks also is going to be lowered. I mean, that's what they're proposing now, apparently, is to be lowered to £1,000.
Disposable assets is a little bit different. We look at two parts of someone's income. We look at, when they come to see us, we look at their income for the previous month. We look at their savings, which I think is possible to have up to 8,000. It's 8,000, yes. And then their disposable income per month, which should be no greater than £733. I don't think I've ever seen an asylum seeker and signed them up and not been able to sign them up to legal help because they've had that quantity of savings. We have to, the LSC who provide us with the funding, they're basically the public
legal,
body.
Legal yeah. Services Commission.
Yes,
yeah.
That's right. They have extremely stringent checks on these forms. So we have to have absolute evidence of what people have and what they don't have before we can even start to give them any advice.
And what about the question I asked Will just now, which is about the sort of general climate, the economic climate, because it seems that it seems a little bit unfair to be doing this at this particular time. What's your thoughts about how this is going to affect your work?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a horrible downward spiral, and I find it incredibly depressing. Will mentioned about the providers, the immigration providers in Bristol that are unable to carry on doing legal aided work. We've now only got three providers, and that includes us. That's us, Southwest Law and Hall & Co are the only ones in Bristol. The Immigration Advisory Service were doing a fantastic job, but they were forced to close in July. They went into administration partially because of the stringent checks that the LSC had put onto them. They were unable to continue. And that's left, I'm not sure,
that's
exact numbers.
That's sort of an extra kind of bureaucratic thing that you then have to go through afterwards, is it?
Pretty much, yes. I don't want to talk too much about the Immigration Advisory Service. They're better qualified to do that. But there were several hundred clients, at least in the Bristol area, that were just left completely. You know, went to the office on Monday morning, a poster on the door saying, closed, sorry. So
whoever caused that, I think maybe they should go to court.
Which, yeah. LSC, public funded body, government.
Well, I suppose the government can't really quite take themselves to court.
It would be nice.
I have to ask Will about that one. Anyway, Will, there is another area we haven't talked about so far. I don't know if you have any dealings with this, and that's private family laws and divorce and custody battles. I think this is one of the things where people would think, well, look, if you want to have a battle about your, you know, over a divorce or that kind of thing, that really you should be paying for it yourself.
Again, you're right. I mean, Avon Bristol Law Centre, we don't take on that work. There are plenty of private firms that are able to do that. It's very difficult for me to speak about how those firms would be able to survive, but I know that there are going to be substantial changes. Effectively, if you've got the money, you will be able to fight and to get the settlement that you want out of any relationship breakdown. If you haven't got the money, the government is saying, well, you've got to go into mediation, you've got to sit round the table and talk, and you've probably got to accept less than you would have done if you'd have had the money to be able to fight it in a court. So it's going to be, you know, the usual one rule for the rich and one rule for the poor. Now, everybody recognises that mediation or alternative dispute resolution, which is one of the kind of technical
sort of settling out of court, isn't
this it? Is kind of, well, rather than going to court and being adversarial, kind of sitting down, talking about things, trying to get people talking about things and being sensible. No lawyer would say that that is not a bad thing. But in many relationship breakdowns, there are an awful lot of other variables that come into it. People are very highly emotive in divorce matters, in relationship breakdowns. There may be also, of course, domestic violence. And one worry that there was about the changes that are being proposed by the government was that because there would be retained legal aid in cases of domestic violence, it might, in extreme cases, encourage domestic violence rather than discourage it. Now, I know that the government have re-looked at that because many of the family lawyers who deal with these horrific domestic violence cases have said, look, you can't do that. You can't allow domestic violence to become a positive issue to enable people to get legal aid. You have to look at family law across the whole spectrum and make it fair for everybody.
Now, I noticed a couple of years ago, from September the 8th, 2009, in fact, in the Evening Post, Local judge David Ticehurst, who sits at Bristol Crown Court, was concerned when they were looking then at possible changes to legal aid that they could have a damaging effect. He said the firms that obtain such contracts will be, by necessity, this is changes to it anyway, to minimise their own expenses and costs, that is bound to lead to a decline in the standards of service available at police stations and in the magistrates' courts. So I wonder, is this actually going to affect that kind of thing, those criminal cases where people find themselves arrested and then they come and see you afterwards?
We don't do criminal law at the Law Centre. It's very difficult for me to talk about the criminal legal aid changes because, to be quite honest, I don't know the nuts and bolts of them.
So you would just refer people on somewhere else if they come saying, oh, I've just been arrested and it looks like I'm going to go on?
We would always refer somebody to a reputable firm of criminal defence lawyers. Yes, that's right.
Okay, and ultimately, give us your quick capsule idea of whether these changes are absolutely definitely going to go through or not. Because at the moment, they're in the committee stage in the House of Commons, this great mouthful of a bill, the Legal Aid, Sentencing and Punishment of Offenders Bill. Is this all going to happen, do you think, or not?
We believe it is going to happen. There will be some kind of changes. There was a phrase that was used in the article in the Western Daily Press, which is that those changes are going to be really just rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic.
What is the Titanic? Is the legal aid system, is it?
The Titanic would be the legal aid system. Yeah, so it is going down. It is going to be very different. What we don't know, I mean, the government have said that they will put some alternative funding in place for advice services. We don't really know what that's going to be. One thing that worries us is at the same time that they're saying that, a lot of the other alternative funding structures that, for example, that the Law Centre also has at the moment in order to keep our services going, we're being told that those funding streams are being cut as well. So it isn't just the legal aid budget that's being cut. The alternatives that are being proposed by the government appear to be being cut as well.
Can you just take us right back to the very start? Why was legal aid brought in the first place?
Legal aid was brought in because people were unable to bring their rights before the courts. Now, what happens if you don't have a decent legal system that people can actually enforce is that people will enforce by other means, and perhaps we've already seen some of that already this summer of how people tend to react in times of great crisis. They take to the streets.
Well, Will Stone and Chris Kelson from Avon and Bristol Law Centre at the bottom of Stokes Croft, thanks very much for joining us on Drive Time this evening.
Thank you.
And we'll have some music now, and after that, the nuclear blockade of Hinkley Power Station next Tuesday. 90s, there's left field there with Original. Welcome to the chill out room, as Martin was just saying. Now we've got a big event taking place down near Bridgewater. I'm joined by Ornella Sabine. Ornella, welcome to Drive Time.
Hi, it's Monday actually.
Oh, it's Monday, okay. Yeah. So can you just tell us what you're doing on Monday?
Yeah, Monday there's a non-violent blockade of Hinkley Power, nuclear power station. And we're hoping it will be a massive act of civil disobedience with people from all over the country coming to say no to new nuclear power.
The whole point of it then is what, to just sort of blockade the entrance to the place or what?
Yes, it's to show our dissatisfaction with the government's programme, their lack of a proper consultation, the lies that they told in the consultation. It's to show how many of us don't want nuclear power in this country.
But, I mean, ultimately, we do need something. You know, we need, we're having problems delivering enough energy because of the close down of some of these coal-fired power stations. So you want to put wind farms up in the countryside?
Well, I think there's lots of different, there's like solar power, wind power, combined heat and power, there's loads of alternatives, and I don't think this will be necessarily, there will be power cuts on that level, plus conserving energy. Nuclear is not going to make any difference to our energy needs because it provides a very small percentage of our electricity needs anyway, and they can easily be replaced.
But it's pretty high tech, isn't it? Well, so what have you got against nuclear?
Well, look at Fukushima, look at Chernobyl. When there's an accident, it becomes an extremely serious accident. If Hinkley or Albury blow up, we'd all be nuclear refugees. We wouldn't be able to come back and live in this area. Also, there's a radioactivity carries on and in our genes, and so it actually breaks the DNA. So that means loads of deformities, and also the fact that they're putting the nuclear waste into weapons. That's what I've got against it.
They're putting the nuclear waste into weapons. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Yeah, depleted uranium and uranium weapons are a byproduct of the nuclear industry. In fact, people say they're a byproduct, but we're beginning to wonder that our nuclear power stations really about electricity, considering the costs, the danger that they pose and how much the government's so into them, when we've got so obviously so many alternatives that we can go for. We're a very technologically advanced country. Even the military themselves are using solar panels now in their drones. You know, they're going more green because they know that oil and all those things are running out. So it's, I've forgotten the question.
the question really was about this being a high tech industry and also the military. What's this connection between? Because I think most of us think of there not really being much of a connection between nuclear power and nuclear weapons. They're two separate things. When we're looking at countries like Iran, for example, what we're saying is it's okay, you can have your nuclear power, but you can't have the weapons.
Well, they are linked with weapons, and they're basically the reason why they were built in the first place in the UK, because the UK wanted to become a nuclear power. And they're very much linked to the military industry, and because the amount of electricity they provide is minimal, really.
Martin, is that true? I mean, you think that the Britain, surely we've got enough plutonium now that we've made out of these power stations to blow up half the world. Why do we need any more?
Well, I mean, there is clearly a link between nuclear power and nuclear weapons. I mean, that's what, I mean, you said earlier that the Iranians are allowed to have nuclear power, but they're not allowed to have nuclear weapons. Well, that's not exactly the case. I mean, the Western powers in Israel are insisting that they can't even have nuclear power. Nuclear power is a high-level technology which basically doesn't pay. I think that's the killer for nuclear power. If the private sector is building nuclear power stations, they have to have all insurance costs taken over by the state. Because if the private companies that ran the Fukushima nuclear plant, they've long ago run out of money, and it's the Japanese government that is now rescuing what's left of Japan's environment. So I would be hopeful, if I were you, Ornella, that because of the economic crisis, they're just going to pull the plug on this nuclear development because it's just too expensive.
Well, it's very interesting because the EDF, the company that's to build Hinkley, and the reason we're focusing on Hinkley because Hinkley is the first of the 10 nuclear power stations that the government has given a go-ahead to. Greenpeace are actually taking them to court. But EDF is €44 billion in debt to the French government, so it's not a private company, it's a company that really is the French government. So we're letting the French government build nuclear power stations here.
Why is it so much in debt?
Because basically the nuclear power industry doesn't pay. It never has. It relies upon government subsidy. I mean, nuclear power was a byproduct of nuclear weapons in the first place, as Ornella points out, for Britain and for everybody else. Basically, if you're going to build nuclear weapons, you then need to have some kind of cover for that, so you have nuclear power as a cover for the fact that you're building nuclear weapons. But it's never stacked up. When they tried to privatise the nuclear industry in the 1980s, the Conservatives were keen to privatise it, but as soon as the City of London had a proper look at the books, they said, "You're joking, we're not picking this up." So there's never been an economic case for nuclear power.
Okay, so Ornella, what are you doing on Monday? What time, where, and if people want to come and watch or get involved, what do they do?
Right, 7 o'clock Monday morning, we're all gathering outside of Hinkley Power Station and we're blockading the gates. People have actually pledged that they're willing to get arrested to stop this. If you want to come, there's transport going from Bristol. You can get a ticket at Booty.
Where's that? That's
Colston Street, a shop in Colston Street. You can get a ticket there to come down for the day. People are coming from all over the country to show the government and EDF that we do not want nuclear power in this country.
And surely, I mean, if I was running Hinkley Power Station on Monday, I'd think, well, I'd just make sure that anybody that was coming to deliver, I'd ask them to come on Tuesday.
Yes, probably, yeah. But this is the first of a massive movement that is building. People are coming from all over the country. It's not just a few people and we're going to give up.
Okay, Ornella, thanks so much for joining us.
The other thing, of course, that costs a lot of money is the nuclear waste. Not only does it cost a lot of money in terms of looking after it for future generations, but it costs a lot of money for a lot for our health and the pollution it creates. And the figures to actually look after this nuclear waste are massive already, let alone if we have more. And you can take the analogy, if the Romans had created nuclear power, we would still be looking after the nuclear waste now. So how are we going to communicate to future generations the dangers of nuclear power?
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Now, is the Pakistan Intelligence Service, the ISI, aiding terror attacks on NATO forces' supply lines in Pakistan? America's war of words continues, but what's really going on and where is this leading? Here is the US General Mike Mullen speaking week before last, in fact, to a congressional committee.
The Taliban have adapted. More than ever before, they are concentrating their efforts on attacks that will produce a maximal psychological impact for a minimal investment in manpower or military capability. The recent truck bomb in Wardak falls into this category, as do the attacks against Kabul, the attacks last week in Kabul, including the one on our embassy. A second but no less worrisome challenge we face is the impunity with which certain extremist groups are allowed to operate from Pakistani soil. The Haqqani Network, for one, acts as a veritable arm of Pakistan's Internal Services Intelligence Agency. With ISI support, Haqqani operatives planned and conducted that truck bomb attack, as well as the assault on our embassy. We also have credible intelligence that they were behind the June 28th attack on the Intercontinental Hotel in Kabul and a host of other smaller but effective operations. In choosing to use violent extremism as an instrument of policy, the government of Pakistan, and most especially the Pakistani Army and ISI, jeopardizes not only the prospect of our strategic partnership, but Pakistan's opportunity to be a respected nation with legitimate regional influence.
That was General Mike Mullen speaking 2 weeks ago to a congressional committee about what appears anyway, certainly to the Americans, to be collusion between the Pakistani Secret Intelligence Service, the ISI, and this terrorist group, the Haqqani Network, who've been blowing up truck bombs and various other attacks right across Pakistan. Now, Martin, this is a bit of a thorny issue, and there's been war of words, really, between one side and another on this one particularly. And, of course, there's the background of the Americans storming in to, at least allegedly anyway, to kill Osama bin Laden. So what is going on here, this war of words?
Well, obviously, it's very difficult for outsiders to say exactly what is happening. Basically, the Pakistanis are saying one thing, the Americans are saying something else. You pays your money, you take your choice about who's telling the truth. I personally don't believe anything the Americans say about any of this. The Haqqani Network was set up in the 1980s as part of Operation Cyclone, and the ISI certainly had a very strong relationship with them. So did the CIA. The CIA were their sponsors previously. And if they're blowing up CIA people and American soldiers now, perhaps they ask themselves the questions, why did we arm and train them in the 1980s? That's the sort of question that the Pakistanis will be asking, saying, well, hang on a minute, you used to like these guys, now you don't like them. But don't blame us for that, because basically you encouraged these people in the first place.
Now, I talked about a war of words. You heard the American side. Now, Lieutenant General Mohammed Asad Duran, who's a former head of the Pakistani Secret Intelligence Service, the ISI. Let's have a listen to what he has to say.
I do not get into the legitimacy, or for that matter even the morality of the business, because otherwise one could be talking about so many actions done by the occupation forces that I will consider as immoral, counterproductive, illegitimate. I'm just talking about the war that is going on in Afghanistan for the last 8 or 9 years. The groups or the organizations like the CIA, MI6, and ISI do not belabor themselves with adjectives like legitimacy and so on. People and missiles from both sides are crossing the border, hitting each other. So that is technically what I described as war. And what is happening today is part of that war, in which a little arm twisting by denying us any financial or civilian aid till we did something else, that is how it gets played.
Now, that's a pretty strong charge there. He's saying that there's actually a low-intensity war going on between Pakistan and the United States.
Well, if you remember the Raymond Davis affair some months ago, where a US agent was captured by the Pakistani police, having killed two people in the street, possibly ISI agents who were following him, and it was all over the Pakistani press that they got hold of his mobile phone, and had been in touch with lots of terrorists inside Pakistan. So there's a group, I think it's called Tehreek-e-something, inside Pakistan, who are a militant jihadi group who the Pakistani military say are being run by the Americans. Now, people say, oh, the Americans don't run illegal terrorist networks. I say, well, yes, they do. They may not in this case, we're dealing with allegations here, but the Islamic Fighting Group have just taken over in Tripoli. They are Al-Qaeda Tripoli. Many of them fought in Afghanistan in the 80s. They've been working with the Western Intelligence Services for many years. General Gul, who was the head of the ISI in the 1980s, worked very closely with the CIA and MI6 to run the Mujahideen inside Afghanistan. General Gul is on the record as saying, as far as he's concerned, 9/11 was an inside job carried out by the CIA and Mossad. Now, this chap, senior Pakistani military officer, I'm as inclined to believe him as I am to Admiral Mike Mullen. Now, if it comes to a war between Pakistan and America, China will side with Pakistan, and I think, as Pakistan is a member of the British Commonwealth, we should side with them against the Americans. That's how it'll have to be.
That's quite an interesting take on it all, but ultimately, I mean, actually, as well, there's an article in the Hindustan Times today, in fact, saying Pakistan asks US to show proof. Pakistan has decided to seek evidence from Washington following the top US military general's allegation that Islamabad is supporting terror strikes on American and NATO facilities in Kabul, it learned reliably yesterday. High-placed sources confided to the Nation newspaper that the foreign ministry had been advised to get active and project their case not only to the US policymakers but also to different world powers in order to present the truth about the Haqqani network.
Well, I think that's right, and I think also what the other point to be made is that many senior Pakistani military people believe that the US and Britain and Israel are involved in fomenting terrorist attacks inside Pakistan. So you've actually got Islamic jihadi networks inside Pakistan which are cooperating with Western intelligence services to destabilise Pakistan, and it wouldn't be surprising in that circumstance for the Pakistanis to be cooperating with people inside Afghanistan to try and remove the Western in occupation forces inside Afghanistan. This is all turning very, very dangerous after the so-called assassination of Osama bin Laden. I say so-called because there's no evidence been brought forward that any kind of assassination took place of Osama bin Laden at all, and many people in Pakistan just simply don't believe what the Americans say about what happened. The Chinese gave an ultimatum to the Western powers, including Britain, said if you go in to Pakistan again without an agreement with the Pakistani government, you are going to war with China. You didn't hear that on Radio 4, did you? But it's all over the press in India and Pakistan. China plays its card. China steps into the ring. China makes its move. We've heard nothing about it in the mainstream press here, have we? Because it didn't fit the narrative about the heroic capture and assassination of Osama bin Laden, where we haven't got a body, any DNA, or a photograph. Nobody believes what we say anymore because we've been so shown to be lying so often in the past. As I say, General Gul, former head of the ISI, worked very close with MI6 and the CIA in the 80s. He says that 9/11 was carried out by the Americans and the Israelis.
Now, you were talking about not much about this kind of thing in the mainstream press, but here's Sunday Express, May the 22nd this year. British scientists are preparing to help American experts take control of Pakistan's nuclear facilities in the event of a raid by Islamic terrorists. The US is on high alert for reprisal attacks after the killing of bin Laden. Pakistan has thwarted 4 such terror attempts on its own in the past years alone. So it sounds to me, Martin, as if NATO is actually ready to go and take control of Pakistan's nuclear facilities. I mean, this could be quite dangerous, couldn't it?
Well, the Pakistanis will resist that. If somebody came to take over our nuclear facilities, we'd resist it. The Pakistanis will resist it. And, of course, the people who really don't like Pakistan having a bomb are India and Israel. And they are definitely determined to disarm Pakistan. I don't particularly like people having nuclear weapons. I don't particularly like the Pakistanis having them. But they're as entitled to have them as anybody else. They're as entitled to have them as we are. And basically, this kind of talk is going to make them dig their heels in, and we will go to war. But if it does come to a third world war, the West can't guarantee to win.
Well, this kind of subject was discussed a couple of weeks ago between the US analyst and historian, who we've had on the show several times, Webster Tarpley, and the US talk show host Alex Jones. So let's see what they had to say about this sort of ramping up of tensions.
I'm seeing major acclimation, major ground preparation psychologically, major rollout preparatory phase for big false flags. They are really hyping it and having army checkpoints with regular police all over the country as a way to condition the public. And then, of course, they can stage terror, blame it on anti-Federal Reserve groups. What is your view on the incredible drum beating that I'm seeing?
On Friday night, I think I put up on my website, topley.net, an alert, right? That basically I would say it's time for something like an orange alert this is because the European banking panic, the U.S. banking panic. It would be very convenient, for example, to declare martial law and under the cover of martial law use executive orders to order another bailout. It would be very hard to get a bailout through Congress for the zombie banks. But if the zombie banks blow, they're going to want a second bailout. And I think the only way to do that is under the cover of martial law. There will be demonstrations now. People will be out there fighting against genocidal austerity imposed by reactionary politicians and Wall Street.
That's Webster Tarpley on the Alex Jones Show recently, and he's referring there to the US, Martin, a sort of parallel tension area. And of course we've seen massive protests in Wall Street which have hardly been reported here on the mainstream news.
Well, I think the real danger is that the banking system is on the brink of collapse, and at that point the powers that be may decide to do all sorts of mad things in order to distract our attention.
OK, Martin, thanks very much. That's all for this week. Coming up next, the Sky News at 7 o'clock. Thanks very much to our guest in the first hour. That was the Lib Dem leader of Bristol City Council and councillor for Clifton, Barbara Jank. Also to old Labour Oxford economist you just heard there, Martin Summers. Next week, Conservative MP Charlotte Leslie will be along, and a drive time special on, guess what? Driving. How have we become so car dependent? Why is public transport limping along? And why and what we drive and how we drive? Might they tell us more than we realise about the character behind the wheel? Join us next week. Just go to thisweek.org.uk and click on the link to our website, our archives. It's Tony Gosling saying thank you very much. See you next week.
UK BCFM News.